"Let us stroll down there a little way," Tom said. "Very carefully." "What did you see, Tom?"
"I'd rather not say. Maybe nothing."
"Keep off the sidewalk, stay under the trees. And that was one hell of a traffic jam. There'll be bodies."
There were dozens rotting their way back into the great scheme of things between Twombly Street and the West Side Cemetery. Misty had given way to a cough syrup rendition of "I Left My Heart in San Francisco" by the time they reached the edge of the trees, and they could again see the red eyes of the boombox power lamps. Then Clay saw something else and stopped.
"Jesus," he whispered. Tom nodded.
"What?"
Jordan whispered.
"What?"
Alice said nothing, but Clay could tell by the direction she was looking and the defeated slump of her shoulders that she'd seen what he had. There were men with rifles standing a perimeter guard around the cemetery. Clay took Jordan's head, turned it, and saw the boy's shoulders also slump.
"Let's go," the kid whispered. "The smell's making me sick."
Chapter 7. In Melrose Corner, about 4 miles north of Rochester, they could still see its red glow waxing and waning on the southern horizon. They came to another picnic area, this one with a little stone fire pit as well as picnic tables. Clay, Tom, and Jordan picked up dry wood. Alice, who claimed to have been a Girl Scout, proved her skills by making a neat little fire and then heating 3 cans of what she called hobo beans. As they ate, 2 little parties of pilgrims passed them by. Both looked. No one in either group waved or spoke.
When the wolf in his belly had quieted a little, Clay said, "You saw those guys, Tom? All the way from the mall parking lot? I'm thinking of changing your name to Hawkeye."
Tom shook his head. "It was pure luck. That and the light from Rochester. You know, the embers?"
Clay nodded. They all did.
"I happened to look over at that cemetery at just the right time and the right angle, and saw the shine on a couple of rifle barrels. I told myself it couldn't be what it looked like, that it was probably iron fence palings or something, but..."
Tom sighed, looked at the rest of his beans, then put them aside.
"There you have it."
"They were phone crazies, maybe," Jordan said,
but he didn't believe it. Clay could hear it in his voice.
"Phone crazies don't do the night shift," Alice said.
"Maybe they need less sleep now," Jordan said. "Maybe that's part of their new programming."
Hearing him talk that way, as if the phone people were organic computers in some kind of upload cycle, never failed to give Clay a chill.
"They don't do rifles either, Jordan," Tom said. "They don't need them."
"So now, they've got a few collaborators taking care of them while they get their beauty rest," Alice said.
There was brittle contempt on top of her voice, tears just beneath.
"I hope they rot in hell."
Clay said nothing, but he found himself thinking of the people they had met earlier that night, the ones with the shopping carts, the fear and loathing in the voice of the man who had called them the Gaten Bunch.
"He might as well have called us the Dillinger Gang," Clay thought. And then he thought, "I don't think of them as the phone crazies anymore. Now I think of them as the phone people. Why is that?"
The thought that followed was even more uncomfortable.
"When does a collaborator stop being a collaborator?"
The answer, it seemed to him, was when the collaborators became the clear majority. Then the ones who weren't collaborators became...
Well, if you were a romantic, you called those people the underground. If you weren't a romantic, you called them fugitives. Or maybe just criminals.
They pushed on to the village of Hayes Station and stayed the night at a tumble-down motel called Whispering Pines. It was within sight of a sign reading Route 19, 7 miles, Sanford, the Berwicks, Kent Pond. They didn't leave their shoes outside the doors of the units they chose. There no longer seemed any need of that.
Chapter 8.
He was standing on a platform in the middle of that damned field again, somehow immobilized, the object of every eye. On the horizon was the skeletal shape with the blinking red light on top. The place was bigger than Foxborough. His friends were lined up with him, but now they weren't alone. Similar platforms ran the length of the open area. On Tom's left stood a pregnant woman in a Harley Davidson t-shirt with cut-off sleeves. On Clay's right was an elderly gent, not in the heads league, but getting there, with graying hair pulled back in a ponytail and a frightened frown on his horsey, intelligent face. Beyond him was a younger man wearing a battered Miami Dolphins cap. Clay saw people that he knew among the thousands and wasn't surprised. Wasn't that how things always went in dreams? One minute you were phone booth cramming with your first grade teacher, a minute later you were making out with all three members of Destiny's Child on the observation deck of the Empire State Building. Destiny's Child wasn't in this dream, but Clay saw the naked young man who had been jabbing the car aerials, now dressed in chinos and a clean white t-shirt, and the guy with the pack sack who had called Alice Little Ma'am, and the limping grandmotherly type. She pointed to Clay and his friends, who were more or less on the 50-yard line, then spoke to the woman next to her, who was, Clay observed without surprise, Mr. Scottoni's pregnant daughter. "That's the Gaten bunch," the limping grandmotherly type said, and Mr. Scottoni's pregnant daughter-in-law lifted her full upper lip in a sneer. "Help me," called the woman on the platform next to Tom's. It was Mr. Scottoni's daughter-in-law she was calling to. "I want to have my baby the same as you. Help me." "You should have thought of that while there was still time," Mr. Scottoni's daughter-in-law replied. And Clay realized, as he had in the other dream, that no one was actually talking. This was telepathy. The raggedy man began making his way up the line, putting a hand over the head of each person he came to. He did this as Tom had over the head's grave, palm extended, fingers curled in. Clay could see some sort of ID bracelet flashing on the raggedy man's wrist, maybe one of those medical alert things, and realized there was power here. The stadium light towers were blazing. He saw something else as well. The reason the raggedy man could reach above their heads, even though they were standing on platforms, was because the raggedy man wasn't on the ground. He was walking, but on 4 feet of thin air.
"Ecce homo insanus," he said. "Ecce femina insana."
And each time the crowd roared back, "Don't touch," in a single voice, both the phone people and the normies, because now there was no difference. In Clay's dream, they were the same. Chapter 9. He awoke in the late afternoon, huddled in a ball and clutching a flat motel pillow. He went outside and saw Alice and Jordan sitting on the curb between the parking lot and the units. Alice had her arm around Jordan. His head was on her shoulder, and his arm was around her waist. His hair was sticking up and back. Clay sat down with them. Beyond them, the highway leading to Route 19 in Maine was deserted, except for a Federal Express truck sitting dead on the white line with its back doors standing open, and a crashed motorcycle. Clay sat down with them. "Did you ecce puer insanus?" Jordan said, without lifting his head from Alice's shoulder.
"That's me."
"And I'm the femina," Alice said. "Clay, is there some sort of humongous football stadium in Koshwak? Because if there is, I'm not going near the place." A door closed behind them. Footsteps approached.
"Me either," Tom said, sitting down with them. "I have many issues, I'd be the first to admit it, but a death wish has never been one of them."
"I'm not positive, but I don't think there's much more than an elementary school up there," Clay said. "The high school kids probably get bused to Tashmore."
"It's a virtual stadium," Jordan said.
"Huh?" Tom said. "You mean like in a computer game?"
"I mean like in a computer."
Jordan lifted his head, still staring at the empty road leading to Sanford, the Berwicks, and Kent Pond.
"Never mind that. I don't care about that. If they won't touch us, the phone people, the normal people, who will touch us?"
Clay had never seen such adult pain in a child's eyes.
"Who will touch us?"
No one answered.
"Will the raggedy man touch us?"
Jordan asked, his voice rising a little.
"Will the raggedy man touch us? Maybe, because he's watching. I feel him watching."
"Jordan, you're getting carried away," Clay said, but the idea had a certain weird interior logic. If they were being sent this dream, the dream of the platforms, then maybe he was watching. You didn't mail a letter if you didn't have an address.
I don't want to go to Kashwalk, Alice said. I don't care if it's a no-phone zone or not. I'd rather go to Idaho.
I'm going to Kent Pond before I go to Kashwalk or Idaho or anywhere, Clay said. I can be there in 2 nights' walk. I wish you guys would come. But if you don't want to or can't, I'll understand.
The man needs closure. Let's get him some, Tom said. After that, we can figure out what comes next. Unless someone's got another idea.
No one did. Chapter 10 Route 19 was totally clear on both sides for short stretches, sometimes up to a quarter of a mile, and that encouraged sprinters. This was the term Jordan coined for the semi-suicidal dragsters who would go roaring past at high speeds, usually in the middle of the road, always with their high beams glaring. Clay and the others would see the approaching lights and get off the pavement in a hurry, right off the shoulder and into the weeds if they had spotted wrecks or stalls up ahead. Jordan took to calling these sprinter reefs. The sprinter would blow past, the people inside frequently whooping, and almost certainly liquored up. If there was only one stall, a small sprinter reef, the driver would most likely elect to weave around it. If the road was completely blocked, he might still try to go around, but he and his passengers were more apt to simply abandon their vehicle and resume their eastward course on foot until they found something else that looked worth sprinting in, which was to say, something fast and temporarily amusing. Clay imagined their course as a series of jerks, but then most of the sprinters were jerks, just one more pain in the ass in what had become a pain in the ass world. That seemed true of Gunner as well. He was the fourth sprinter of their first night on Highway 19, spotting them standing at the side of the road in the flare of his headlights, spotting Alice. He leaned out, dark hair streaming back from his face, and yelled, "Suck my rod, you teeny-bop bitch!" as he slammed by in a black Cadillac Escalade. His passengers cheered and waved. Someone shouted, "Tella!" To Clay it sounded like absolute ecstasy expressed in a South Boston accent.
"Charming," was Alice's only comment. "Some people have no..." Tom began, but before he could tell them what some people didn't have, there was a scream of tires from the dark not far ahead, followed by a loud, hollow bang and the tinkle of glass.
"Jesus fuck," Clay said, and began to run. Before he had gotten 20 yards, Alice blew past him.
"Slow down, they might be dangerous," he shouted.
Alice held up one of the automatic pistols so Clay could see it and ran on, soon outdistancing him completely. Tom caught up with Clay, already working for breath. Jordan, running beside him, could have been in a rocking chair.
"What are we going to do if they're badly hurt?" Tom asked. "Call an ambulance?"
"I don't know," Clay said, but he was thinking of how Alice had held up one of the automatic pistols. He knew. Chapter 11 They caught up with her around the next curve of the highway. She was standing behind the Escalade. It was lying on its side with the airbags deployed. The tail of the accident wasn't hard to read. The Escalade had come steaming around the blind curve at maybe 60 miles an hour and had encountered an abandoned milk tanker dead ahead. The driver, jerk or not, had done well to avoid being totaled. He was walking around the battered SUV in a dazed circle, pushing his hair away from his face. Blood gushed from his nose and a cut in his forehead. Clay walked to the Escalade, sneakers gritting on pebbles of safety glass, and looked inside. It was empty. He shone his light around and saw blood on the steering wheel, nowhere else. The passengers had been lively enough to exit the wreck, and all but one had fled the scene, probably out of simple reflex. The one who had stuck with the driver was a shrimpy little post-adolescent with bad acne scars, buck teeth, and long, dirty red hair. His steady line of jabber reminded Clay of the little dog who idolized Spike in the Warner Brothers cartoons.
"Are you all right, Gunner?"
he asked. Clay presumed this was how you pronounced Gunner in Southie.
"Holy shit, you're bleeding like a mother! Fucking A, I thought we was dead!"
Then to Clay,
"What are you looking at?"
"Shut up," Clay said, and under the circumstances, not unkindly. The redhead pointed at Clay, then turned to his bleeding friend.
"This is one of 'em, Gunner. This is a bunch of 'em."
"Shut up, Harold," Gunner said. not kindly at all. Then he looked at Clay, Tom, Alice, and Jordan.
"Let me do something about your forehead," Alice said.
She had reholstered her gun and taken off her pack. Now she was rummaging through it.
"I've got band-aids and gauze pads, also hydrogen peroxide, which will sting, but better a little sting than an infection, am I right?"
"Considering what this young man called you on his way by, you're a better Christian than I was in my prime," Tom said. He had unslung Sir Speedy and was holding it by the strap as he looked at Gunner and Harold. Gunner might have been 25. His long black rock vocalist hair was now matted with blood. He looked at the milk tanker, then at the Escalade, then at Alice, who had a gauze pad in one hand and the bottle of hydrogen peroxide in the other.
"Tommy and Frito and that guy who was always picking his nose, they took off,"
the red-headed shrimp was saying. He expanded what chest he had.
"But I stuck around, Gunner. Holy fuck, buddy, you're bleeding like a pig."
Alice put hydrogen peroxide on the gauze pad, then took a step toward Gunner. He immediately took a step back.
"Get away from me. You're poison."
"It's them," the redhead cried. "From the dreams. What'd I tell you?"
"Keep away from me," Gunner said. "Fucking bitch. All of you."
Clay felt a sudden urge to shoot him, and wasn't surprised. Gunner looked and acted like a dangerous dog backed into a corner, teeth bared and ready to bite. And wasn't that what you did to dangerous dogs when there was no other recourse? Didn't you shoot them? But of course they did have recourse, and if Alice could play Good Samaritan to the scumbag who had called her a teeny-bop bitch, he guessed he could refrain from executing him. But there was something he wanted to find out before he let these two charming fellows go their way. "These dreams," he said. "Do you have a kind of spirit guide in them? A guy in a red hoodie, let's say?" Gunner shrugged, tore a piece off his shirt, and used it to mop the blood on his face. He was coming back a little now, seemed a little more aware of what had happened.
"Harvard, yeah. Right, Harold?"
The little redhead nodded.
"Yeah, Harvard. The black guy. But they ain't dreams. If you don't know, it ain't no fucking good telling you. They're fucking broadcasts. Broadcasts in our sleep. If you don't get them, it's because you're poison. Ain't they, Gunner?"
"You guys fucked up big time," Gunner said in a brooding voice, and mopped his forehead. "Don't you touch me."
"We're gonna have our own place," Harold said. "Ain't we, Gunner? Up Maine? Fucking right. Everyone who didn't get pulsed is going there, and we're gonna be left alone. Hunt fish, live off the fucking land. Harvard says so."
"And you believe him?" Alice said. She sounded fascinated. Gunner raised a finger that shook slightly.
"Shut your mouth, bitch."
"I think you better shut yours," Jordan said. "We've got the guns." "You better not even think about shooting us," Harold said shrilly. "What you think Harvard would do to you if you shot us, you fucking punk-ass shorty?"
"Nothing," Clay said. "You don't," Gunner began, but before he could get any further, Clay took a step forward and pistol-whipped him across the jaw with Beth Nickerson's .45. The sight at the end of the barrel opened a fresh cut along Gunner's jaw, but Clay hoped that in the end this might prove better medicine than the hydrogen peroxide the man had refused. In this, he proved wrong. Gunner fell back against the side of the abandoned milk tanker, looking at Clay with shocked eyes. Harold took an impulsive step forward. Tom trained Sir Speedy on him and gave his head a single forbidding shake. Harold shrank back and began to gnaw the ends of his dirty fingers. Above them, his eyes were huge and wet. "We're going now," Clay said. "I'd advise you to stay here at least an hour, because you really don't want to see us again. We're leaving you your lives as a gift. If we see you again, we'll take them away." He backed toward Tom and the others, still staring into that glowering, unbelieving, bloody face. He felt a little like the old-time lion tamer Frank Buck, trying to do it all by pure force of will. "One more thing. I don't know why the phone people want all the normies and cashwalk, but I know what a roundup usually means for the cattle."
"You might think about that the next time you're getting one of your nightly podcasts."
"Fuck you,"
Gunner said, but broke his eyelock with Clay and gazed down at his shoes. "Come on, Clay," Tom said. "Let's go." "Don't let us see you again, Gunner," Clay said. But they did. Chapter 12. Gunner and Harold must have gotten ahead of them somehow, maybe by taking a chance and traveling 5 or 10 daylight miles while Clay, Tom, Alice, and Jordan were sleeping in the State Line Motel, which was about 200 yards into Maine. The pair might have laid up in the Salmon Falls rest area, Gunner hiding his new ride among the half a dozen or so cars that had been abandoned there. It didn't really matter. What mattered was they got ahead of them, waited for them to go by, and then pounced. Clay barely registered the approaching sound of the engine or Jordan's comment.
Here comes a sprinter.
This was his home turf, and as they passed each familiar landmark, the Frano Lobster Pound, 2 miles east of the State Line Motel, Shakey's Tasty Freeze across from it, the statue of General Joshua Chamberlain in the tiny Turnbull Town Square, he felt more and more like a man having a vivid dream. He didn't realize how little he'd expected to ever reach home again until he saw the big plastic soft-serve cone towering over Shakey's. It looked both prosaic and as exotic as something from a lunatic's nightmare, hulking its curled tip against the stars.
"Road's pretty littered for a sprinter," Alice commented.
They walked to the side of the road as headlights brightened on the hill behind them. An overturned pickup truck was lying on the white line. Clay thought there was a good chance the oncoming vehicle would ram it, but the headlights swerved to the left only an instant after they cleared the hilltop. The sprinter avoided the pickup easily, running on the shoulder for a few seconds before regaining the road. Clay surmised later that Gunner and Harold must have gone over this stretch, mapping the sprinter reefs carefully. They stood watching, Clay closest to the approaching lights, Alice standing next to him on his left. On her left were Tom and Jordan. Tom had his arm slung casually around Jordan's shoulders.
"Boy, he's really coming," Jordan said.
There was no alarm in his voice. It was just a remark. Clay felt no alarm either. He had no premonition of what was going to happen. He had forgotten all about Gunner and Harold. There was a sports car of some sort, maybe an MG, parked half on and half off the road just 50 feet or so west of where they were standing. Harold, who was driving the sprinter vehicle, swerved to avoid it. Just a minor swerve, but perhaps it threw Gunner's aim off. Or perhaps not. Perhaps Clay had never been his target. Perhaps it was Alice he'd meant to hit all along. Tonight they were in a nondescript Chevrolet sedan. Gunner was kneeling on the back seat, out the window to his waist, holding a ragged chunk of cinder block in his hands. He gave an inarticulate cry that could have come directly from a balloon in one of the comic books Clay had drawn as a freelance.
"Yah!"
and threw the block. It flew a short and lethal course through the dark and struck Alice in the side of the head. Clay never forgot the sound it made. The flashlight she had been holding, that would have made her a perfect target, although they had all been holding them, tumbled from her relaxing hand and sprayed a cone of light across the macadam, picking out pebbles and a piece of taillight glass that glinted like a fake ruby. Clay fell on his knees beside her, calling her name, but he couldn't hear himself in the sudden roar of Sir Speedy, which was finally getting a trial. Muzzle flashes strobed the dark, and by their glare he could see blood pouring down the left side of her face. Oh God, what face? In a torrent. Then the gunfire stopped. Tom was screaming.
"The barrel pulled up. I couldn't hold it down. I think I shot the whole fucking clip into the sky."
And Jordan was screaming.
"Is she hurt? Did he get her?"
And Clay thought of how she had offered to put hydrogen peroxide on Gunner's forehead and then bandage it.
"Better a little sting than an infection. Am I right?"
she had said. And he had to stop the bleeding. He had to stop it right now. He stripped off the jacket he was wearing, then the sweater beneath. He would use the sweater, wrap it around her head like a fucking turban. Tom's roving flashlight happened on the cinder block and stopped. It was matted with gore and hair. Jordan saw it and began to shriek. Clay, panting and sweating madly in spite of the chilly evening air, began to wrap the sweater around Alice's head. It soaked through immediately. His hands felt like they were wearing warm, wet gloves. Now Tom's light found Alice, her head wrapped in a sweater down to the nose, so that she looked like a prisoner of Islamic extremists in an internet photo. Her cheek, the remains of her cheek, and her neck drowned in blood. And he also began to scream. "Help me," Clay wanted to say. "Stop that, both of you, and help me with her." But his voice wouldn't come out, and all he could do was press the sopping sweater against the spongy side of her head, remembering that she had been bleeding when they had first met her, thinking she had been okay that time. She had been okay then. Her hands were twitching aimlessly, the fingers kicking up little sprays of roadside dirt. "Somebody give her that sneaker of hers," Clay thought. But the sneaker was in her pack, and she was lying on her pack. Lying there with the side of her head crushed in by someone who'd had a little score to settle. Her feet were twitching too, he saw, and he could still feel the blood pouring out of her, through the sweater, and over his hands. "Here we are at the end of the world," he thought. He looked up in the sky and saw the evening star. Chapter 13. She never really passed out, and never fully regained consciousness. Tom got himself under control and helped carry her up the slope on their side of the road. Here were trees, what Clay remembered as an apple orchard. He thought he and Sharon had come here once to pick, back when Johnny had been small, when it had been good between them, and there had been no arguments about money and ambitions and the future.
"You're not supposed to move people when they've got bad head wounds,"
Jordan fretted, trailing along behind them and carrying her pack. "That's nothing we have to worry about," Clay said. "She can't live, Jordan. Not like she is. I don't think even a hospital could do much for her." He saw Jordan's face begin to crumple. There was enough light for that. "I'm sorry." They laid her on the grass. Tom tried to give her water from a Poland Spring bottle with a nipple end, and she actually took some. Jordan gave her the sneaker, the baby Nike, and she took that too, squeezing it, leaving smears of blood on it. Then they waited for her to die. They waited all that night. Chapter 14.
She said, "Daddy told me I could have the rest, so don't blame me."
That was around 11 o'clock. She lay with her head on Tom's pack, which he had stuffed with a motel blanket he'd taken from the Sweet Valley Inn. That had been on the outskirts of Methuen in what now seemed like another life. A better life, actually. The pack was already soaked with blood. Her one remaining eye stared up at the stars. Her left hand lay open on the grass beside her. It hadn't moved in over an hour. Her right hand squeezed the little sneaker relentlessly. Squeeze and relax. Squeeze and relax. "Alice," Clay said, "are you thirsty? Do you want some more water?" She did not answer.